Hi, this is John Ryan, and welcome to the Team Handball News Podcast. Joining me again is Julia Taylor, on direct from France. Julia, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks. How about you?
Not too bad. We're gonna delve into different topics today. Last time was just kind of a catch-up, learn about Julia, learn about what the U.S. women's team is doing. But today we're going to talk more about some of the different training environments Julia has had and discuss some of the pros, cons, and benefits. But first, before we do that, I need to let you know that this Team Handball News podcast is brought to you by Hummel's online shopping portal for the U.S. and Canada, shopteamhandball.com. With handball season right around the corner, be sure to check out shopteamhandball.com for all your handball needs. Shop Team Handball has got uniforms, tracksuits, balls, stick'em, and more, all available at its online portal. Got questions? Feel free to contact Jordan Fithian directly, and he'll do his best to answer them. Get your season started off right with Hummel and shopteamhandball.com. All right, so that's taken care of. It's like we were talking offline. I was looking at your bio at usateamhandball.com, and I like to think that I, John Ryan, have seen it all. I've done everything. I'm Mr. Know-It-All. But I was looking at your bio and all the different training environments that you've seen, and I have to admit, I don't think anybody has seen it all quite the way that you have. And I'll just rattle through. You've played at the collegiate level. You went to the Aarhus Academy, so you had a residency program, if you will, in Europe on an individual basis. Mm-hmm. You have trained with a residency program in Auburn, and now you've trained with a club program in Europe. And those pretty much cover all of the different types of environments. Someone who was born and raised in the continental United States could mm-hmm. have handball. Obviously, somebody, dual citizen that grew up in Europe is going to have a lot more youth-oriented opportunities. But from age 18 on, you've seen it all. And so I thought we'd kind of talk a little bit about those different training environments, the pros and cons, and from your perspective, what's worked for you, what you would like to see better, what doesn't work the way you might want it to work, and just have a discussion about these different environments. So
yeah, sure.
Kind of a broad opening. I don't know where we should start. I guess, you know, maybe we should start where you started. You know, talk about the collegiate handball program and how it developed you as a player.
Yeah, so I mentioned in my first in the part one of this interview that my collegiate experience, I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and their club program there was my first real experience with handball, and I think, you know, in terms of you know, seeing as handball is not a well-known sport in the U.S., it's not well-developed. There are people who think it's the sport where you go and you hit the ball against the wall. You know, in North Carolina, we call that wall ball, but I guess some people call that handball. Just in terms of getting the general American population familiar with the sport, I mean, the club scene is it's a good way to start out, you know. But, you know, I think there's maybe 10 women's clubs in the entire U.S., there's, what, two collegiate clubs on the women's side in the whole U.S.? I mean, in terms of creating competitive handball players, it's maybe not necessarily the best route. In that sense, you know, I think that the American club scene is lacking quite a bit, you know, especially compared to our European counterpart. So
you never got to play against anybody else collegiately but West Point. Did you guys ever beat West Point?
Of course we beat West Point. Honestly, I am offended that you asked.
Well, you know, they've been dominating for a long time, you know, so.
That's true. You know, like West Point, we compare them, you know, I went to Carolina. West Point was kind of our Duke for the handball world. You know, there's that rivalry. There's that get under each other's skin kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, we beat them a good times, you know, good number of times. They beat us a good number of times. So, but yeah, we got our hand in there.
You know, and that's where, you know, sometimes I get on my high horse a bit and I'm like going, why make West Point your Duke? You know, What can Carolina handball do to make Duke your Duke? You know, a rival that you can, you know, get in your car and go play after a 15-minute drive.
That is the golden question, John. And I remember, you know, when I first was really getting dedicated to handball and really getting into the university club athletic scene, and that was a question that we would toss around. You know, I was vice president of the club team for 2 years, and I would sit down with the president, it was Diva Desai at that time, and we would talk about this. You know, like, what can we have 1,000 universities in North Carolina? There's like 50 within the Triangle, you know, the Raleigh Durham area. Like, what can we do to build these programs so we can just walk over next door to Duke and play, or to NC State? And you know, there's so much that goes into developing clubs at the university level, and I think the biggest thing is finding a coach who's willing to put in the work and the hours that it takes. Because, you know, I've known Wade for many years. Wade Sutton, Miles Bacon, they were my two coaches at Carolina. I've known them for many years. And what they do is unpaid. And they've put in thousands of hours into these clubs, you know. And it's hard to find a Wade or a Miles at every university, you know. It requires a level of thankless work that not a lot of people are willing to do, yeah. Unfortunately.
And to me, I see that as, you know, a bit of the shortcoming with the collegiate environment. I think it's a good way to learn, you know, right now, the way it's set up. It's a good way to learn the basics of the game, understand the rules, understand the basic movements. And mm-hmm. I mean, at Carolina, how many times did you guys practice per week?
Twice a week. Yeah.
Twice a week. I mean, that's good. You know, and granted, you can play other schools other than collegiate, and you can learn a lot when you go up against some of the what I would say predominantly expat teams, particularly on the mm-hmm. women's side. I've always said you learn a lot by playing those people that think, they don't look very athletic, but, you know, they've been playing it forever, and they school you with something you've never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and I guess that, you know, that's where I think, you know, if there is a discussion, it's, you know, maybe funding should go towards, you know, somebody to, you know, develop collegiate programs in mm-hmm. in a specific area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what if somebody was paid, you know, to mm-hmm. set something up at Duke and get it established and get it going so that, you know, like it's like we talked earlier that Carolina has gone down a little bit, I guess, in terms of its organization and level of participation. But there's still something there. And, you know, there's been mm-hmm. some sustainment brought on with the women's program there, even if it's not quite as big as what you were there. It's still there, and it's still competing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe if there were more teams nearby, there would be more of a sustaining mechanism, you know, to play each other. I had a podcast interview where I talked with somebody from the rugby community, and basically that's what's happened. You know, there's enough club teams around all over the place that they kind of help each other along just simply by having somebody to play with and to keep the programs up and running. Yeah, it's like you said, it's tough. It's tough to do it all from a volunteer standpoint.
Exactly.
I'm putting some words in your mouth. I say you developed a little bit of understanding of the game. Then you go off to Aarhus and, mm-hmm. you know, tell me about that experience and training environment there and how beneficial that was for your development as a player.
Yeah, so the sports academy that I was at in Aarhus is it's a pretty common thing that they do in Denmark. You know, students will take either a year off from school or between their equivalent of high school and going off to university, they'll enter the sports academy. The school that I was at was specialized in soccer and handball. And the year before I came to Aarhus, they had the British Olympic team came and trained there to prepare for the 2012 London Olympics. So there was, at that time when I came, there was maybe 20, between 15 and 20 handball players. And I would say about 10 of us were international players. And the goal, you know, for the Danish players that are there, the goal is to get there to get some high level coaching and training and to hopefully be able to sign a pro contract. For the international players, you have kind of two groups. The first group is, of which I'm a part of, was to learn what handball is, develop our technical skills, you know, get to know the game better. And then the other half being, you know, again, the same same idea of, you know, trying to break into the pro world. So
just real quickly, some of those Danish players and somebody trying to break into the pro world, what level would they go into in the Danish league system?
I think it varied quite a bit. I remember from my time there, there was a young man who plays for the Estonian national team, I believe, who came in, was there for, you know, maybe a month or two and signed a first division, you know, professional league contract right off the bat. And then there were others. I think of the two British Olympians there that were there at the same time as me, I think that they were playing maybe third division or second division. I was having a fourth division club. So, I mean, it varied quite a bit. You know, there's all kinds of levels there. But the majority of the people there had a significant handball background already under their belts. So,
yeah. How did you think you developed as a player there? I guess it's kind of hard to come up with a numbering system of 1 to 10. Let's say if you started out at UNC,
mm-hmm.
first day you were a 0.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that let's say long-term goal. Let's say you wanted to get up into a higher league. Let's mm-hmm. say that you wanted to improve to the point where you got to the French professional league, the top league in France. Let's say that's a 10 for you.
Okay.
and I guess, you know, let's say right now you're like at a, I don't know, a 7.
Okay.
It's just kind of a pathway, it will.
Sure.
Where do you think that you were after you left the UNC program on the way to Aarhus? Where would you think you were on that 0 to 10 scale?
Probably a 1 or 2, honestly. You know, I probably thought I was higher than that, but I would say probably a 1 or 2. And I think the biggest reason is that I had no idea what real handball was, you know, not detracting by any means from the Carolina program, but I mean, handball in the U.S., I mean, you've seen handball in Europe. You know very well what I'm talking about. It's a different game in Europe. And so going over to Denmark, I think that was the biggest thing, is just playing alongside these girls who've played their entire life, who the movements are second nature to them. It's natural. You know, they know how to move. They don't have to think or hesitate, or they just react. And, you know, in terms of athleticism, in terms of physicality, no problem. But it was, for me, it was immersing myself in the techniques and the tactics of the game. So I was there for a semester, so about 4.5-5 months, and I would say my level jumped up considerably. If I had stayed another semester, you know, the full year, it would have brought me even farther. But it was definitely in Denmark that I really started to nail down, you know, that foundation for real handball skills.
Yeah. And then you know, let's say you were like a 4, maybe 5. I don't know. It's
Yeah, we'll say 4 or 5.
So you go back to UNC, and, mm-hmm. and now I would suspect that when you played with your club team at UNC those next couple years, you were the one teaching people based on what you had learned just in that short semester there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I looking back, I wish I had done more of that. I wish I had done more of helping my teammates develop and, you know, coaching where I could and whatnot. But I, you know, I hope I was able to contribute a little bit to the development of my teammates and to the strengthening of the team as a whole.
I forgot you're kind of a selfish player. You know, just calling it for yourself. No, I'm just kidding. You know, because, you know, that is tough. I mean, and I have seen that before. You know, somebody has come from, like, the residency program, or maybe they played in Europe. You're still a player. You're maybe not ready to go, you know, into that coaching mode. I mean, mm-hmm. You are helping, but it's you know, just because you have that additional expertise doesn't necessarily make you a natural for teaching that expertise, some of those innate things that you've started to pick up and not have a second nature about thinking about.
And, you know, I that's a very good point. And I think that's, I'll be the first to admit that my ambition, you know, I got that taste of high level handball. I came back from Denmark and played in my first national team event. And for me, it was, I was one track minded, you know, and so coming back to Carolina, I had my goals, you know, I had that taste of higher level handball and I was uniquely focused on that, you know, so I think that there was coming back to Carolina, I let my ambitions take precedent over, you know, it was more my priority to accomplish my goals as, you know, as a player than it was to maybe develop those around me. So in that sense, you know, I feel like I wasted a little bit of opportunity to help contribute to the American handball scene, to the club handball scene. I could have brought those skills that I learned and helped to develop, you know, my peers a little bit more. But at the time I was one track minded, you know, I was focused on making it to the next level.
Yeah. Now, but you were kind of, I would guess I'm going to again, put words in my mouth. You're kind of in a dry spot in terms of development. You've mm-hmm. picked up some skills in Denmark. If you're playing practices at North Carolina, you're now probably better than the people that you're practicing with. And then you mm-hmm. only get, you know, a handful of games, you know, at the club level. So you're not mm-hmm. you're not in the same intense training environment, I guess. I don't know if your skill is a trophy or you just maintain what you've learned, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's it was a tough balance. You know, fortunately, when I was there, I had a few teammates who were also in the national team pool, Lisa Dunn, Diva Desai. You know, there's a couple of girls who were also had higher ambitions for handball, you know, so we were able to kind of keep each other accountable a little bit to push each other. So even though not everybody was on the same level and, you know, for some people it was still just recreational, there were others who had national team ambitions, you know, I still, you know, was able to find those teammates who could push me nonetheless in that sense.
Sure. All right. So you graduate, they open up the program at Auburn, and now you're in a national team residency training environment. Now I'll give you a little bit of my experience for what it's worth. I'll be the first to admit I'm a has-been who never was. Yeah, maybe a little bit more, but because I did get a play in the world championships, but you know, I was maybe the second or third worst player on a mediocre team. I'm comfortable in middle age. I know what I was. you know, I had the environment playing collegiately 1 year at Air Force. And then on a club team, I think, that took things pretty serious in California, the Ventura Condors, when they were practicing more on a regular basis. And, you know, I moved to Colorado Springs. I had no real plans of playing on the national team, and I just wanted to kind of keep playing, and I would show up at their practices, and they needed guys, and, you know, I just kept practicing. And I got to the point where I was like, well, these guys aren't that much better than me. You know, I started to take it more seriously, more dedicated. And the reality is, in a training environment for me on a daily basis, I improved dramatically in a short period of time. You know, maybe better athletes, better players would have done even more so. But, you know, a month for me in a full-time residency program was like maybe a year in a club training environment in the U.S. I improved dramatically, especially at the, you know, like that first year there. So that was my experience. What was your experience?
Yeah, you know what, I like I said in the last podcast, I came out to the Auburn residency program right when it started. We were four at the beginning for a couple months. And over time, you know, I was there in the year leading up to 2015, which was our major year. You know, we had three or four major competitions. That was our Uruguay qualifier for Pan Am Games. And it was tough because, you know, my plan ever since coming back from Denmark was to go back to Europe eventually and to sign a contract. So for me, Auburn was a, you know, it was a stop on the way to my ultimate goal of playing in Europe. And I ended up sticking around for a year and a half there, which was longer than I originally intended. And it was excellent. The first couple months, it was excellent for me as a player because we were not as many. So Christian was able to really focus in on us as individual players and really develop us tactically, technically, really hone in on our weaknesses. I mean, Christian is an excellent developmental coach. You know, he knows the drills. He knows how to explain it to us, especially with American athletes. You know, he has many years of experience with American athletes, so he knows how to shape and how to develop an American athlete to become a handball player. So I would say those first couple months were extremely beneficial. And then just in terms of overall athleticism, you know, I was playing alongside most of my teammates. I think almost all of my teammates were former Division I athletes, you know, and being amongst this group of elite athletes really made me step up my game in terms of conditioning, you know, pushing myself physically. I think that was a big area in which I improved. But, you know, you can only do so much playing with the same group of 10 to 15 girls every day in a small town in the U.S. And there was definitely a point where I plateaued and got very frustrated. You know, there is a period of several months where I think that was my biggest driving force for leaving Auburn eventually, because it's excellent for developing players, but you know, the end objective should not be to stay in Auburn, but should be eventually to launch these players that were developed in Auburn onto the professional scene in Europe. And I think that's, you know, Christian and I have had conversations about that. I think that was his ultimate vision with the residency program, is that it could become a developmental grounds to eventually launch players into the pro leagues, you know? So it was, for me as a player who had some years of experience under her belt, it was beneficial for the first couple months until it wasn't anymore, I guess is the most blunt way to say it.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit, to me, I think being able to play in competition and to scrimmage is, mm-hmm. to me, I think that's pretty important. Now, maybe it's because for me, you know, I never really developed offensively as a player the way I would like to have. And so I kind of started focusing on defense. And, boy, if you're not playing in games, you're not learning how to play defense as a unit, you know, at the number three position. So maybe that's my perspective. You know, maybe with a lot of one-on-one type drills, I would have become, you know, that circle runner that, you know, turns on a dime and scores every time, mm-hmm. flawlessly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I sort of started to get that, you know, after like the, towards the tail end of the second year of my program. But maybe that was, you know, my limitations as an athlete. But, you know, for you, it was a little bit different. A lot of that one-on-one instruction, just, you know, drills and learning, I guess, how to make that wing shot the way you need to make that wing shot was beneficial for you.
It was. And you know, like I said, at first when we were only four players and then six players and then eight players, it was excellent. And then once we got a good, you know, 15 to 20 girls, that was, you know, really deep into 2014. I think we were starting to really gear up for that big year of 2015. And one thing I really appreciate about Christian's plan in that time frame was that he was having us leave and do friendly competitions. I think we were doing it maybe every 6 to 8 weeks. You know, we went to Guadeloupe in the Caribbean. We went to Puerto Rico. We played Canada. We went to Brazil. You know, we made sure to get in those friendly games because it's like you said, you know, if you're not playing those games, you can only progress so much, you know? Yeah. So, you know, getting those friendly games was essential. And it was definitely needed in that those months prepping for that 2015 year. Yeah. So
I'm going to go on a couple tangents here. You know, first one is you talked a little bit about the D1 athlete. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the level of competition that they've had in that regard. I was not a D1 athlete, all right? I certainly could play basketball, I think, at any Division III program in the country and done well. But, you know, I learned enough from playing against different people that skill-wise and athleticism-wise, I just wasn't quite there. You know, if I had been in a different program, maybe I would have had enough skill-wise that I could have taken my limited athletic ability to play maybe at a small D1 school. But I've got my doubts. And from your experience, I guess, and I guess I'm saying, you know, when I played against athletes that were of that level, I would say, like, yeah, they've got some skills athletically that I don't have. Similarly, and now I'm putting words in your mouth, you played different sports in high school. You say you never really found one that you loved, but, I mean, was do you look at yourself athletic-wise that you could have played Division I in some sport?
That's a good question. I think just in terms of overall athleticism, you know, speed, coordination, you know, my vertical, whatnot, I think I had the tools. Had I really committed to one sport, yeah, I think I could have. Just, you know, and that's not a question that I would have been able to answer in college or even in high school. But now, you know, after playing, you know, competing against elite athletes and playing alongside elite athletes, I think just in terms of overall athletic prowess, I think that I would have had the tools had I, you know, honed the skills.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I've always said, like, if I grew up in East Germany back in the 70s, they would have seen me play basketball and say, you are a better handball player. You play handball now. You know, so I think if I was ever going to be an elite athlete, I mean, my skill set probably would have targeted toward handball. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I'm getting at here is you get into a long debate that you have. It's like, hey, you know, Julia Taylor, she's not a D1 athlete. She's got some skills. She started at a younger age. Do we need more athletes like that? Or, you know, hey, we're not going to get the good athlete till they turn 23 and they're done with their collegiate D1 career. We're going to, you know, we're going to bring that athlete in. And so it's kind of a, I'm trying to frame this into a question, I guess. I'm not really framing it into a question. You have a mixture of people that are brand new to the sport coming into you there at Auburn. Mm-hmm. And then you got, you know, somebody like you who's on their own and has taken their game to a level. You know, and I don't think the Federation has really come to grips with what type of athlete they're looking for. I mean, you can say both. But you need to set up the programs that's going to get you both, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps you. I mean, take it wherever you want.
I see the dilemma, and it's a really good question because, you know, I have a teammate who was in the similar situation as me in that she started out handball. Well, at a much younger age than I did, great handball player, was not a Division I athlete either. But the difference between her and I is that she never developed that work ethic that you find in Division I athletes. You know, I think it's you know, you look at a Division I athlete coming out of college, 22, 23, and you wonder, like, are they too old to learn the skills for this brand new sport? You know, how long are they actually going to stick with it? But there is something to be said for that just natural drive that they have, that mindset, that killer instinct that they've developed. And I think, you know, it's something that I've adopted, that I've learned to adopt from them. Since, you know, I didn't have the same experiences as a D1 athlete that they did. But I, you know, I think that there is something to be said for that. That's, you can take non-Division I athletes and teach them handball young and hope that maybe, you know, their years of experience in handball will make up for that lack of elite athleticism, we could say. But, I, you know, it's hard because there's that push, that killer instinct that's missing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. And I will say, I think, though, that for some, I think it also just depends on the mentality of the person involved. I think some Division I athletes, after they have put that time in on their chosen sport for as long as they have, they graduate and they have the mindset, you know, I'm done.
Yeah.
I need to move on with my life, take that mindset and apply it to my career.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. And then you also have some that says, you know, like, I'm still hungry. I still mm-hmm. want to do something. I still want to, you know, take it to the next level. So I think that varies from person to person. And you probably had the mindset and the dedication level that some of those athletes had taken. Although conversely, you could say that, you know, maybe you hadn't gone through that experience yet, so that you hadn't been burnt out, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. And I think, too, you have to take into account that, you know, let's say you have this great D1 athlete that's finished with their school. They're not ready to give up that competition yet. They come into handball and they're like, wow, like, I'm really bad at this. You know, it requires a certain type of athlete, even amongst the elite athletes. You know, not everybody can start a whole new sport and be okay with sucking for a while, to put it bluntly. You know, we had a girl on this trip, to the most recent trip we did to Korea, who was an elite D1 volleyball player. And we had conversations where she'd say, like, it's hard because I'm used to being good. You know, my whole life I've been this elite volleyball player, and I come here and I am lost and I look terrible. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to step out on the court and suck when you've been a star your whole life. So, I mean, it's that mental aspect that you got to take into account too. You know, not every athlete is willing to go through that.
Yeah. And continuing this discussion, my second tangent, and you kind of brought it up, and one that, you know, has frustrated me a little bit is the concept of the pro launching pad.
Mm.
And we'll go in the way back machine to when I was playing. It certainly wasn't a launching pad to my pro career.
Sure.
But you take a guy like Derek Heath. At that time, after the World Championships, and even before, he was saying, "Hey, you know, I need to support my family. I want to, you know, pursue a pro career," and it was not encouraged, you know. And I have talked with some other players more current, and they also had indicated at one time it wasn't being encouraged, and I don't think it is written down anywhere. I think it should be, you know, in terms of what you're trying to accomplish with a residency program, whether it's a program to get all your players together and train them as a team for competition, or you're trying to develop players so that they can go to Europe and a launching pad for their next career.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cop-out is to say, well, we're going to try and do both. And my perspective is, well, you can't really do both and excel in both of them.
Sure.
Obviously, if the goal was for, you know, the resident team program had everybody train together, I would say, well, Julia, I think it's great that you're at Aulnay and everything, but you need to come back and, mm-hmm. you know, train as a group, you know, full time. Or if your goal is to graduate players, if you will, as a launching pad, then you need to be looking for the players that are actually going to be able to go off and do that. And I don't think, this is me speaking, I don't think the Federation has really definitively said which one they're trying to do.
I think that there's two big factors to take into account with that. The first being, what is the vision of the coach? And then second being, what are the ultimate objectives of the players themselves? You know, because on our team on the women's side, you know, you have one group of players who they join the residency program to train for Team USA. You know, their ultimate goal is, be it Pan Am Games, be it the Olympics, but it's Team USA. And then on the other hand, you have a second group who playing for Team USA is definitely, it's a goal, it's a privilege, but it's not the ultimate goal. And I think I fall more into that second group where I wanted to do everything I can to play for Team USA to contribute to the national team, but I also want to see how far I can go in the European League, you know? And in that case, I think that defines very much the trajectory of the players in the residency program, because a player whose ultimate goal is to make it to the Olympics and not compete in Europe, they don't have much motivation for leaving the residency, you know? And then in terms of the vision of the coach, you know, I think Christian's ultimate vision with the residency program, you know, he uses Brazil quite a bit as a model with us, talking to us as players, that they have kind of a developmental mindset for their residency program. It's where their B team lives and practices and trains and whatnot, with the ultimate goal of going and signing a contract in Europe, you know. And I ideally know that he would love for all of us to be linked up with D1, D2 teams, and he can just call up our clubs and choose from these players based in Europe, you know. But it's not the reality of the situation, you know. It's not the ultimate goal of all the players in the residency. So two factors in consideration.
Yeah, I would even argue that if you had a residency program, maybe you shouldn't have a national team coach running it. And I guess if you were looking at the first aspect, you know, to send players overseas, mm-hmm. Then if you're not the national team coach, you're not like on, well, I got a competition coming up, I'd rather have these guys here with me and, you know, preparing for that event. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the real problem where you don't even have enough people to populate the program effectively. Right. You know, so you know, I agree, you know, it's like, but the objective of the coach or whoever's running the residency program, you know, that should be spelled out as to, you know, what the overall intent is.
Yeah.
Because what you do and how you set it up and the types of players that you bring in,
mm-hmm.
you know, all depend on what you're trying to accomplish.
Right.
Yeah, I just feel like it's not a no-brainer. It's something that needs to be discussed. It's something that you need, that the Federation should really look at, in terms of what the long-term goal is, what the short-term goal is, and whether the short-term goal, you know, should, take a backseat to the long-term goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in an ideal world, the residency program would be strictly developmental, you know, recruitment, development, preparing athletes to go and try and, you know, break through in the professional league. I think there's so many factors that come into play, and so many, you know, the money issue, the, you know, the fact that our players start off in their mid-20s, you know, there's so many things that come into play. But I think the fact that that we don't have the – man, how can I say this? We don't have the level, even after being trained and developed in Auburn, it is rare for us to have a player who can go and sign a professional contract in Europe. So to tell a player, your next step is to go into Europe, but you're going to be signing with a third division team or a fourth division team. You're going to be scraping by on a semi-pro salary, and you're going to have to work on the side – You know, it's tough to ask that of a mid-20s, late-20s something woman, you know? I mean, I think that it's we're not at the place in terms of just American handball where we can, you know, sign players to pro contracts right off the bat and not have to worry about that.
Yeah, it's you know, it goes to the old overall pyramid, you know, and if we can't set up something that's going to put that top of the pyramid to go get that contract, you know, then maybe we need 10 North Carolinas and West Points, or 100 North Carolinas or West Points, or 500 North Carolina and West Points, you know, so that we can bring in these players maybe when they're not at that age where, you know, they're not ready to go to Europe and kind of start all over at the bottom, I guess.
Right.
I just feel like, you know, those discussions need to take place, and you need to come up with the overall objective. I think we've kind of touched on that. You and I are not going to solve that problem, mm-hmm. Or that catch 22, if you will. We got a little bit on a sidetrack, but I think it was an interesting discussion. Continuing on the 0 to 10 learning scale. Let's say you came out of Aarhus and your post Aarhus skill, you know, skill development at North Carolina as a 4 or 5. You went to Auburn. It sounds like the beginning part was really good. It kind of plateaued, and I don't know. You tell me where you are on that scale. I guess if we said you were a 7 now, maybe it took you to a little bit further down that path.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was like a 4 or 5 coming out of Aarhus in Carolina, maybe 5, 6. I think I can't stress enough how important my experience in Europe has been, especially these last two years in France, where I've really been anchored with a club. You know, our club plays games every weekend. We're training full time. We have an objective as a team. You know, I think it's really there that has both made me realize where I'm lacking in terms of handball players, you know, kind of handball skills, kind of made me realize where I stand a little bit and pointed out where I need to improve, where I'm stronger than the other players. But, you know, I will say that it's actually a conversation I've had with Christian coming off of these last couple events we've had, is that I've taken a bit hit to my confidence as well being over here, you know, going from being one of the core American players in the whole country to coming here to Europe and being a you know, small time player in a big pool of great athletes who've been playing their entire lives. You know, it's definitely a factor that I didn't expect to come into play, was the psychological aspect of that. So
how have you developed? I mean, what are the aspects, how have you gotten better as a player with your time in France?
I would say that in terms of just technique and tactics, there hasn't been too much of development. You know, I think that really my time with Christian and in Aarhus was really where I was able to develop most of that. But it's just been making everything natural, making, you know, the speed of the game. You know, I've gotten accustomed to a much higher speed of the game. So when I come back to Norca, for example, or even in Argentina against most of the teams we played, save Brazil and maybe Paraguay at times, I mean, the speed of the game is much faster. You know, decision-making, just better decision-making, cleaner passes, cleaner shooting, you know, not being able to be lazy or get into bad habits. It's just a faster, cleaner level of play. And I think that's really the biggest area in which I've improved, is just becoming accustomed to a more elite level of play, you know?
Do you think that you are a better finisher? I mean, if you look at the wing position, that's where you got to be a finisher. You got to be somebody that consistently can put the ball in the net and have a repertoire of shots, an ability to recognize what the goalie is doing and to score against that goalie. Mm-hmm. Do you think you've become a better finisher?
I do and I don't. I will say that I do because I've faced very good goalies here. You know, I've faced much better goalies than I was facing in my club time at, you know, at Carolina. And in that sense, you know, I've had to learn how to read the goalkeeper, how to wait, how to react, anticipate and whatnot. But like I said, you know, it both with being thrown into an environment where I was one of the lesser players on the totem pole, you know, that, and then the whole, like we talked about the last podcast in terms of the different aspects of the rules regarding the foreigners and not getting to play a lot of games, you know, that in that sense that my, like I said, you know, my confidence took a bit of a hit. And so in that sense, I would say that it's, you know, it's been playing, it's a little bit of a mental game for me in that sense.
You feel, though, that you are in a good situation now with the team, that you will be getting a lot of playing time on a consistent basis and the chance to improve your game as you are you're playing more consistently. You're getting more of a set idea of where you fit in with your team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it would be interesting to have this same conversation at the end of this season.
Well, yeah, you know, I will. You know, we'll talk about you signing with a D2 team, you know, in France or something like that.
Sounds good.
One aspect of your game I think I have noticed as well as I can watching video is I think that you you really get out on the fast break pretty well and put yourself in a position to score there. I think that your timing for that sort of thing is like, oh, she's ready again to score when that opportunity is there. At least that's something I've noticed.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the benefits of being here in Europe and being accustomed to that faster style of play is reacting faster, both on the fast break and on the retreat, you know, because I mean, that shot goes off and they're gone, you know? And I think that comes with the timing, with the style, with the speed of the play, the level of the level of play here. That's definitely been one of the biggest benefits for me being over here.
Yeah. Well, I am glad that you are in a good situation and, you know, really have sounds like a good opportunity to, you know, to see what you can do. Sounds like this year you're really going to have that opportunity to, you know, establish yourself as, you know, one of the better wings in your league. Or, yeah, you know, maybe that won't happen. Maybe you know, say, hey, you know, I've become good, but you know, maybe this is the level I have. But it sounds like you got that opportunity to really see what you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have a great opportunity ahead of me, and we have big projects as a club here, big plans. So I think this year is going to be, it's going to be pivotal. It's going to be a good year coming up.
Well, all right, Julia, any other closing thoughts, any burning issue or, you know, subject I didn't cover?
I think we touched all the bases. You know, I think that there's a lot of questions. I think, you know, there's so many different ways of running a residency program, of developing a team, and it's so hard with the limited funding that we have, this very small pool of players that we have. But, you know, I will say that regardless of whatever differences in ideologies or approaches that we might have within the Federation, we have nonetheless an extremely dedicated group of individuals, players, coaches, staff, and whatnot. And
absolutely, you know, I always try and stress that anytime I have a commentary where John Ryan is going to say something bad about us again, I always try to assess, you know, to emphasize, I should say, that there's no way anybody can fault any of the players and mm-hmm. the tremendous sacrifices you guys are making. I mean, there's just no way. Anybody that wants to fault the attitude the hard work and, you know, how you guys are good representatives for our country. You know, they're just, I don't even want to have a conversation with them. That doesn't hold water in my opinion. You know, but I guess that being said, where I come from is, you know, I think there's some bigger picture issues, you know, that need to be looked at to give our country and our players the best opportunities they have to succeed. And mm-hmm. you know, that's where I think the debate needs to take place. Mm-hmm. And where I get frustrated is I just don't see that debate happening.
But yeah.
I'm a little sidetracked now. I don't make it all about my opinions for whatever they're worth. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you, and I look forward to following your season and hearing good things. Good things are happening both for you and for the women's national team.
Yeah, well, thank you, John. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, for Julia Taylor and for our sponsor, ShopTeamHandball.com, I'm John Ryan, and thanks for listening.